Hello, you're listening to the download of The Business of Film with me, Mark Kermode, from BBC Radio 4.
I live around here in Silver Lake, right over the reservoir, and I come here every Saturday and Sunday morning for breakfast at the crack of dawn. Well, there's, 6 million kinds of producers. I'm the kind of producer who finds material or in magazines or newspapers or pop culture. I got Ridley Scott, I got Robert Redford, I got Jodie Foster. I think I never put together a better team in my whole life. Literally every night I went to bed believing I had kept the movie together for one more day. And every morning I woke up to another catastrophe. Suddenly, every night was a dilemma of holding the piece together, holding the movie together. So then I would have to go around and say to everybody, no, Jody, Bob's not falling out. No, Bob, Jody's not falling out. And every morning when I thought I had successfully held the movie together, I woke up to a phone call from the press like the one I remember getting from Claudia Eller that said, Linda, if you don't tell me every single thing that's going on in this picture, I'm going to ruin you. This kind of mind-bending displacement of any perspective makes you think that you're the center of the world. And I remember at one point I called Nora. And I was like, Nora, this is the most difficult thing I've ever done. My picture's falling apart and coming together every day. It's like a sandcastle. And she said, Linda, the Hutus are slaughtering the Tutsis. You're losing all perspective. This is not life and death. And I said, Nora, I think it is.
Hollywood producer Linda Obst, whose credits include The Fisher King, Sleepless in Seattle, and Interstellar. A matter of life or death. Is this how the movie business feels to those who work in it? Tonight at the Academy Awards, some seasoned and familiar faces will walk up to collect their Oscars. But this series is about the people behind the scenes, the ones who decide what we see and when we see it. Over the course of this three-part series, I'll be trying to unravel how movies get funded, how they get distributed, and why the film business is an industry like no other.
The film industry has to reinvent itself every year. Every film distribution and production company has to build its business from the start, and every film itself is effectively like a startup business.
David Cossey, formerly of Universal Pictures, now head of Film 4.
Some of those startups then succeed so dramatically that they become businesses in themselves. An example would be something like the Harry Potter franchise, but most of them are just one-offs.
Now, that sounds unbelievably risky. So how do you minimize that risk?
Well, it is. The film business is risky, but the returns are occasionally massive. So it's a high-risk, high-return business. In the film business, if you really look at it, it is almost a break-even business, except for the sequel business. The American studios are each part of massive conglomerates, and they are focused on making movies that appeal to the entire global audience. Audiences in Asia, Latin America, China, Russia, which over the past 5 or 10 years have changed in importance and have, I believe, skewed the kinds of movies that those studios are making. So they're looking to create brands that they can grow and exploit worldwide. They can transfer to theme parks, games, television shows. So they're in a very big industrial business. You know, in the independent film world, which is most of the British film industry, is focused on developing and trying to get movies made and then figuring out how they're going to be distributed.
In England, most people think it's an achievement to get a film made, which I think is crazy.
British producer and director Matthew Vaughan, the man behind Lockstock, Kick-Ass, and the current cinema release, Kingsman.
I mean, if we start talking about the British film industry, I am possibly the most hated man in it.
Tell me why.
Because we don't have a British film industry. And I'm bored of everyone saying we do have one, and I think it's crazy that we subsidise British movies with tax breaks, but we don't get any of that money back, and we're subsidising Hollywood. and we're service providers. We're not an industry, we're being a glamorised service provider. If France or the Italians suddenly said it's a 30% tax break, they're gone.
For Matthew Vaughan, movies like the Harry Potter and Star Wars films may be made here and benefit from our generous tax rebate system, but they are owned by Hollywood studios, who take the lion's share of the profit. Yet even in Hollywood, the industrial home of cinema, the idea that nobody knows anything has long held sway.
Movies are a very, very odd way to make a living. Directors, nobody wants this director anymore. Nobody wants that writer. Nobody wants that editor. Screenwriters are the basis, I think, of everything. If you have a shitty script, even if you had Bergman or Fellini, it's not going to work as a movie.
An Oscar-winning writer and celebrated Hollywood memoirist, William Goldman wrote such classics as The Princess Bride, Marathon Man, and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
I had a wonderful summer, the Butch Cassidy summer, but that was a different world, you know. George Hill and I met every day at his office on the Fox lot. We talk about this and talk about that and this line and that line. And then we had Redford and Ross and Newman in for 10 days so that when the shoot actually happened, the movie went like a dream. Before the movie shot, they wouldn't do that today. Nobody has the least idea what movie's going to work. And nobody has the least idea, is it going to be a phenomenal success or is it going to tank?
William Goldman's declaration that when it comes to the entertainment industry, nobody knows anything, has long haunted the film business. Even audiences can miss a cult classic in the making.
I think I was probably the last person in Hollywood to get the script. I think literally it had food stains and mustard on three pages.
The son of an advertising salesman, producer Adam Fields, whose credits also include The Breakfast Club, used a bit of showmanship to get his 2001 cult hit Donnie Darko off the ground.
I had gotten originally Jason Schwartzman cast in the lead. He had just finished Rushmore, which I had seen and I thought was just spectacular. And I put it in the trades that I was making the movie and I made an arbitrary date, you know, like 6 months away. And suddenly my phone started ringing and I was getting actually angry phone calls from agents in the casting department going, why haven't you told me about this? What other parts are available? You know, then the movie just started to cast itself with Nola Wiley and Drew Barrymore came on board. And then ultimately Jason Schwartzman left the picture and we placed him with Jake Gyllenhaal. But at that point I was able to already raise the meager $4 million that it took to make the film.
Why are you wearing that stupid bunny suit?
Why are you wearing that stupid man suit?
The original film, when we premiered at Sundance, was, I think, 2 hours and 40 minutes, and it was just too long. It sat unbought for a long, long time and then got a very meager theatrical release in, I think, three theaters, and we grossed $168,000, and that was the end of it. And it was right at the beginning of Netflix. It became one of these films that young people discovered, and they felt like they found it. And it became their movie. You know, you take nothing for granted.
No expression, no expression.
Doing it for about 15 years now, finally got a film made, sold one to Bryan Singer about a year ago that I'd already been working on for 9 years up to that point, and it's about an outbreak of Ebola, would you believe, on a plane.
The author of a revelatory book called Tales from Development Hell, David Hughes is also a screenwriter who has experienced the process firsthand. And if there's one axiom about screenwriting that holds true, it's that your screenplay will be rewritten. And rewritten.
I wrote that about 10 years ago. But the most bizarre thing is that when I finally got it
sold. Ebola suddenly became so hot. I got a call that said, well, I don't think it should be Ebola anymore because it probably won't be hot by the time we get the movie into production. So it's back in development hell for the most bizarre reason.
So explain to me, what is development hell?
Well, development hell is what you get into when a film is kind of developed beyond a reasonable and sensible period of development. But in that time, you know, actors and directors sort of come and go, and each one, and executives as well, and each one wants to put their own imprint on the property. And therefore, something that's hot one week might suddenly be incredibly cold again. And so they put it back into development, and then it does has another round of cast and crew attached to it. And if that continues long enough, then you kind of, you know what it is. It's development hell. That's where you are.
Are we talking about loss of time or money in the end?
There's a bit of money that gets lost when the film doesn't get made. I mean, Warner Brothers, for instance, they had to pay over $10 million to Tim Burton and over $10 million to Nicolas Cage to keep their schedules free so that they could possibly make Superman Lives. And they didn't make the film, but it cost them a fairly eye-watering chunk of change. However,
eye-watering chunk of change not to make it.
Not to make it. It's a heck of a lot cheaper to not make the movie. But a film that you actually make, these days, it might cost you, if it's a tentpole movie, you know, one of those movies that's kind of that holds up the studio, it could cost you $200 million. And that's another reason why development hell is so kind of prevalent in Hollywood. It's a hell of a lot easier to give another screenwriter $500,000 to have a crack at it, to see if they can come up with something better than what you've got.
You know, there are some 50,000 screenplays registered at the Writers Guild every year. There's a superabundance of content and no real effective filtering mechanisms beyond the agencies and management companies.
In 2005, Franklin Leonard was working as a development executive at Leonardo DiCaprio's production company. His job was to find good material, but if there were good scripts out there, then they were failing to get through.
Either I was doing a very bad job, or my job was reading terrible scripts and passing on them. Either way, my mother's frequent phone calls asking me about law school were something that I needed to pay more attention to. I was about to go on vacation for 2 weeks. I knew I was going to be reading a lot of scripts, and I wanted those scripts to be good. So I sent an email to 75 of my peers saying, send me a list of your 10 favorite scripts from this year that haven't yet been made. And the only precondition is that you love these scripts. And I aggregated the information and sent the list back out and put a vaguely subversive name on it. And when I came back from vacation, it had been forwarded back to me several dozen times and it had become a thing very quickly.
He called the mail out the blacklist, a reference to the McCarthy years, during which left-leaning screenwriters found themselves unable to get their scripts to the screen.
You know, we've done the list every year for the last, this will be the 10th year. It is very difficult to make a good movie without a good script. You can make a bad movie from a good script, but good luck making a good movie from a bad script. So, you know, there were movies that on the list that probably would have gotten made regardless. The Social Network is a great example of that. But then there are also scripts like Argo that Chris Terrio, who wrote the script, has said point blank that Ben Affleck found out about the script for Argo because of the blacklist. You know, there have been 970 scripts on the list. 270 of those movies have been made, and about those movies have made about $23 billion in worldwide box office.
In order for the blacklist to exist, there must have been some kind of blockage in the system. There must have been something that was stopping those scripts getting through. What was that blockage, and do you think it still exists?
If you're a working agent and you get an email from someone you don't know, you're going to be significantly less likely to read that than from someone you knew from college or someone you knew from college's son or daughter. There's a real value to great storytelling and great writing separate from the project on its face being commercial. When I read something like Lars and the Real Girl, there was no way I was going to walk into my boss's office and say, we need to make this movie tomorrow. The follow-up question was, well, what's this movie about? And my answer necessarily is, it's about a guy who buys a sex doll, treats it like his girlfriend, and, you know, sort of experiences emotional catharsis as a consequence of that. It's a lot easier to walk into my boss's office and then follow it with, and 40 people thought it was one of their favorite scripts of the year. That makes them more likely to take it seriously.
Scripts are one thing, but films are driven by their casting.
how casting started was the typist or the secretary in the studio with a Rolodex. Yeah. It was always the backroom girl sort of going, oh, yeah. So, and I think for many years, casting directors just went along with that. Just a picture.
Stars sell pictures, and producers look for parts in a script that can attract strong casts. It's part of putting together a saleable package. Susan Shotmaker, a leading light of independent film, cast the low-budget hit Martha Marcy May Marlene, the film which made a star of Elizabeth Olsen.
It is painting to me. And so for me, when I look at that, every face, every person in it must really match that place. Unfortunately, the machine itself can't function like that all the time because it's business.
There's a certain amount of pressure because they are raising their financing based on, you know, foreign territory sales. And if they don't raise that, then we don't have a film.
Kerry Barden has cast more than 200 films, including Good Will Hunting, Dallas Buyers Club, and Winter's Bone, the last of which gave Jennifer Lawrence her first major screen role. More and more, financial decisions play a key role in casting.
And, you know, the list is the five same women and the five same men, and they certainly can't work on every film that's trying to find financing. That list is usually generated by a finance team. I have a list of actors that I like, but I feel like the list that I put together is not necessarily always the same list that the financial paradigm is coming up with. You know, for example, if you get George Clooney, you've got your financing in place. But if you don't get George Clooney, then you have to figure out what other combinations are going to get your financing together. And so there's different tiers of, okay, we need one person, or we need two people, or we need three people from list A, list B, or list C.
And the worst kind of situations really are when people come to you with a fixed idea of who they want and you know up front that that person isn't going to really do that film and you have to negotiate your way through that. Usually they're extremely famous, but you have to go through the motions and that can become excruciating.
How do you finally resolve those situations? Do you just explain that those people aren't going to, although they're not the right person, or you find somebody better?
Well, the old Susan Shotmaker would yell a lot, and the new version of Susan Shotmaker would simply let it organically come about that maybe those people are never going to do the movie.
The challenge to even get a film made is different now. There's an actor that, you know, may be viable next year that hasn't come out in the movies that he's shot or she has shot. Like when we did Winter's Bone, it's like Jennifer Lawrence wasn't meaningful. A year later, everybody wanted Jennifer Lawrence for their independent film. I see that, and it's very difficult to convince these people that are basing their financing on foreign sales to talk to the people in Germany and Japan and all those people and say, you guys have to pay attention to this because next year you're going to want this actor. And they aren't able to take that gamble, I guess, with their investors' money.
Name actors and actresses are, in theory at least, an insurance of bankability. One of the most critically well-received UK films of last year was the sci-fi flick Under the Skin, which boasted the astonishing vision of Hollywood icon Scarlett Johansson cruising the streets of Glasgow as an alien searching for human meat. Based on the novel by Michelle Faber, it spent 13 years in development.
We were finishing making Sexy Beast, Jonathan Glazer's first film. I gave the book to Jonathan. It had elements that would appeal to him in terms of the type of director he was. And he liked the book and spoke to it and, you know, came on board as a director.
Jim Wilson, producer of Under the Skin.
We started developing a script. We worked with one writer. We quickly realised that that wasn't the film Jonathan wanted to make. We then started working with another writer, and the script changed again. But still, it wasn't quite there. And I'm compressing a lot of work. And then we worked with a third writer, Walter Campbell, who's someone who had worked with Jonathan on his commercials career, creating all those iconic ads, the Guinness surfing horses, etc. And what Walter and Jonathan had was a kind of intuitive, visual understanding of each other. And it was that incarnation, we came up with a script that began the journey towards the film that people saw. And that script was budgeted, and it came out at about $40 million. We couldn't get that film made. And we spent a good few years trying to make that, the $40 million version of Under the Skin. There was a sort of a penny-dropping moment. It actually happened with Tessa Ross, the then head of Film 4. And we sat down with Tessa one Christmas, and she said, look, you guys, can you only make this film for $32 million, which was the latest target we'd been given, or can you make it at any cost? And that necessity being the mother of invention, we sort of decided, no, we want to make it. So then we took this script, and the character played by Scarlett was on a farm, which was closer to the book. There was a male character who American movie star attached to play Brad Pitt. Yeah. But nevertheless, we couldn't get that version made.
Having gone, therefore, from a $40 million budget film with Brad Pitt potentially attached to a film which is a much lower budget, for a substantial portion of which is Scarlett Johansson driving down Socky Hill Street in a white van, picking up guys off the street that we've certainly never seen before on screen, although that process may be described by many people as development hell, actually, it was the making of the film.
You're absolutely right. It was development hell at times because it took hellishly long. You know, it's easy to doubt and have crises of conscience and think, is it ever going to get made? But you're also right that it pushed us into discovering a creative idea that I think was much more interesting.
Well, for me to make everyone in that room, for my PR people out there, cringe, the director of that film makes millions of pounds a year. So if it's such an important movie, he should be financing it himself, not expecting people's tax money to experiment with other people's money. I think that's wrong.
Under the Skin was financed with a number of investors, of which Film 4 and the British Film Institute both committed close to their record production investments of £2 million each. Is this the sort of film, acclaimed yet perhaps not hugely profitable, that the lottery-funded BFI should be backing? Matthew Vaughan.
That sort of film should have been made. You could have made that movie for a couple of hundred grand. You can have cultural importance, but done in a way that it's commercial. Why wasn't his company financing that? I just think it's wrong.
We don't means test filmmakers. We don't means test producers. We make a decision as to whether we think that the project is creatively sound.
Ben Roberts, director of the BFI Film Fund, is responsible for overseeing their lottery investments in film.
Under the Skin is not a very commercial film. Do we want films like Under the Skin to exist? Because if we do, we probably have to accept that we cannot expect anybody to invest in an exercise which is financially incredibly risky, but culturally and creatively can be very satisfying. It is on many people's best film of 2014 list. And you have to put some of that down to the fact that someone's invested an extremely long period of their life and some public money into a creative process.
One, two, get down!
Independent cinema acts as a counterweight to studio-produced films. It's where filmmakers grow as artists, even if they sometimes have to function like business people. There isn't one single formula for financing films, and we'll talk more about this next week. But British writer, producer and director Matthew Vaughan has more experience than most, not only in getting his films made, but also getting them distributed, so they can actually be seen in cinemas.
I aim to make money every time I make a film. I can touch wood when I say this, but I've never lost money on a movie yet. And I'm, you know, crossing fingers and knocking wood because, as people say, it's going to happen eventually, and I'm sure it will. You know, I started off as a producer and as a financier, so I had to become independent because no one would finance the movies.
Vaughan produced Guy Ritchie's Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels in 1998, but he faced a chorus of no's when he tried to get someone to release the movie theatrically.
After screening Lock, Stock and being told no, no one wants it, and it's going to go straight to VHS. It was the best deal we had. And then Kick-Ass, same thing. Nobody wanted it, and I got told to go straight to DVD. Each time, I then vowed I would retire. The only reason we got distribution on Lock, Stock was before then I'd done a record deal because we couldn't afford to clear the rights. So then I had to ring up, I think it was called Osman, A&M guy, and I said, look, I'm really, really apologetic. We can't sell it. And he went, that is ridiculous. I said, yeah, I know. I don't know what to say. So he rang up Polygram, because Polygram owned A&M at the time. So the Polygram guys watched it again,
And having already turned it down.
Having already turned it down, and through gritted teeth said, we're doing Osman the favour here, we're going to buy it, just for England. So I was sitting there going, OK, well, beggars can't be choosers, and I think we're going to be released from two screens. So then I rang up Trudy Styler, who put money in, and said, Trudy, do me a favour, can you get Tom Cruise to come to this buyer screening in America? And she went, are you mad? You used stars for the premieres. And I said, no, there's never going to be a premiere of this. And Cruise, to his credit, turned up in this tiny little screening room on the Sony lot, and it was hysterical because you have all these mid-level executives sitting there, and Cruise walked in, and he just saw them all sit up and pay attention, all getting on their phones, and suddenly all these senior executives joined the screening because Cruise was there. And at the end, Tom got up in front of everyone and said, this is the best movie I've seen in years. You guys will be fools not to buy it. Had a bidding war because of that. And bang, we made all our money back, and my film career officially started. It came from nearly ending to starting at that point.
Vaughan went on to direct the anarchically violent comic strip adaptation Kick-Ass with a budget of £35 million, which he raised independently. Again, no one wanted to distribute it until it screened at the Comic-Con convention.
And we came on after Avatar. So as Avatar did the big presentation, and then we came out, and the place went crazy. Bang, bidding war the next day. I mean, it blew the roof off. Then the bidding war came, and then we sold it for a lot more than what we made it for.
Do you think of yourself as part of the British film industry? I know you've said there isn't one to speak of, but you also speak passionately about making films here and making a British film industry. So do you feel part of it?
100%. I'd love the industry to grow, be more self-sufficient. If Hollywood doesn't come here, what's left? The rules are changing pretty quickly, but I don't want to be like the guys running the record business and suddenly seeing Steve Jobs has stolen it, because Hollywood's just, they're like a bunch of pigs in a trough, not realising that food's running out, and they're just eating it as quickly as possible, but no one's putting food in anymore. And we make the best movies in the world, commercially and artistically. Look at the Oscars. So why are we not building an industry around this absolute talent that we have?
Next week, we'll explore how films get financed and distributed, from the studio-backed blockbusters to the award-winning independent features. It's a risky business, the business of film. Thanks for listening to The Business of Film with me, Mark Kermode, a Hidden Flack production for BBC Radio 4. You can find many other programmes to listen to and download for free at bbc.co.uk/radio4, including the film programme.